WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. COVID cases are on the rise, and it'll be a few weeks before a new booster is available. CBS's Elaine Cahano.
COVID is making a comeback just in time for holiday travel.
I have not yet had COVID. I am the comorbidity kid, and so I am careful.
With cases on the rise, some retailers are running out of tests. Walgreens tells CBS News, we are seeing greater demand, which may cause temporary and isolated shortages. In Los Angeles, cases have doubled in the last month, with nursing homes hit hard.
A convicted murderer is on the loose in Chester County, Pennsylvania. Danilo Cavalcante, who was found guilty of killing his girlfriend, escaped from a county jail yesterday. Chester County DA Deb Ryan.
Law enforcement is still utilizing helicopters, drones, and dogs, and we believe that he is still in the general area. There is no evidence at this time to suggest that anyone has helped facilitate this escape or is assisting him at this time.
Two former Proud Boys members are sentenced for their roles in the U.S. Capitol attack. Ethan Nordine, one of the Proud Boys leaders, has been given 18 years. CBS's Willie James Inman has more on another former member sentence.
Dominic Pozzola has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for his actions on January 6th. The Proud Boys member was the first to breach the U.S. Capitol using a police riot shield to smash a window. In court Friday, the 46-year-old was near tears, telling the judge he had given up politics in a plea for leniency. But as he was taken out of the courtroom, Pozzola raised his fist and shouted, Trump won. Ha ha. You all know it.
The former owner of the famed Harrods department store in London, whose son was killed in a car crash along with Princess Diana, has died. His family says he died Wednesday at 94. CBS's Christopher Cruz with more on Mohammed Al-Fayed.
The self-made Egyptian billionaire businessman was portrayed in the Netflix series The Crown as a grasping foreigner trying to buy his way into high British society.
British manners and customs rule the world. With your help, I will become that rare thing. A British gentleman.
Al-Fayed was devastated by the death of his son Doty Fayed in the crash and spent the rest of his life mourning and fighting the British establishment that he blamed for the deaths of his son and the princess. Christopher Cruz, CBS News.
This has been a day of vigils across Hawaii to honor the sun, the creation of the Hawaiian Islands, and pay tribute to ancestors and those who've died in the Maui wildfires. This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. In response to the potentially record-breaking heat this weekend, the Children's Museum of Eau Claire will open its doors with pay-as-you-can admission. This will give parents and kids a great opportunity to get out of the house on a hot day in an air-conditioned museum with opportunities to learn. The pay-as-you-can admissions will run from Friday to Sunday this weekend. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has proclaimed September as College Savings Month in Wisconsin, encouraging Wisconsinites to save for higher education using the Wisconsin 529 College Savings Program. Governor Evers said this program supports our students and families saving for and pursuing higher education and has become a trusted resource for helping transform the lives of tens of thousands of Wisconsinites who have received its tax-advantaged benefits while developing a higher education savings strategy and a college and career readiness plan. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
If you care about animals or crops, you probably care how the weather could impact both.
It's summer in Wisconsin, and the success of your efforts often depends on knowing the forecast. Count on your local Civic Media weather team for all the information you need.
Crops roots are also growing deeper in search for water, which is bad news because when rain finally falls, it will sit shallow and be absorbed in the top layers of the soil.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the app.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed. Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
New all-electric buses in nearly 200 cities to cut local air pollution and emissions, and officials say they're cheaper to operate. And finally, in Ecuador, in a historic national referendum, Ecuadorians voted overwhelmingly to ban oil drilling in Yasuni National Park in the Amazon rainforest, one of the most diverse biospheres in the world. It's hailed as a historic example of climate democracy, and it was also a victory for indigenous peoples and conservationists.
I will share that hailing. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, this week, as we talked about the other day, the administration moving on the overtime threshold, something, if you remember, during the Obama years, they wanted to set up, I think it was like $47,000 to be exempt from overtime. And you know, Trump whacked that back down to somewhere in the 35 range. Well, the Biden folks have said, no, we're gonna put that back where it should be, somewhere up around $55,000, which I'm all in favor of. We should have done this. Should have done this years ago. This should be, again, another one of those things like minimum wage, tacked to inflation, that goes up as inflation goes up so that it's not eroded away and that you don't work for 100 hours a week for pennies. But here to share some thoughts on this story and, you know, if this is a big deal or not, I've asked Marcus Barham to come talk with us. Marcus is a contributing editor over at Capital & Maine, capitalandmaine.com, the website, if you want to check out the great work that they do. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So walk me through what's going on here. What's the point here? Why are we doing this?
Well, we're doing this because for literally over 40 years, tens of millions of American workers who have worked overtime, meaning more than 40 hours a week, which is, you know, time and a half. We all recognize that concept, you know, good pay for good day's work and more pay for when you work extra hours. And that has been eroded over time. And so fewer and fewer Americans were earning overtime. Literally tens of millions of Americans were losing out on that money because different ways. I mean, number one, the federal threshold was kept low for a very long time. Until 2004, the threshold at which you automatically are entitled to overtime was about $10,000. So it went from, in 1975, you had 62% of American workers, salaried workers, were eligible for overtime. By 2016, that had dropped to about 7%.
Wow.
So from 62% to 7% over 40 years. It's incredible. So that means that's tens of millions of American workers who lost out in overtime. And so there have been efforts to increase that over the years. Obama tried. They doubled it from what was then the threshold of 23,000 to 47,000, meaning anyone who made less than 47,000 would, if they worked more than 40 hours a week, would qualify for overtime. But that was knocked down by a Texas judge. And then the Trump administration, a few years later, increased it slightly from 23 to about 35,000,
right,
which covered about 15% of American workers, full-time workers. But you know, many people considered it not adequate, of course, because 35,000 is still, you know, far lower than the average salary. And because, are you there?
Yeah.
Sorry, I just, okay. And because it didn't have automatic inflation adjustments every year. What's big about the Biden thing is that, number one, it raises it to 55,000, which is much closer to the average salary. So it'll include at least 3 million more American workers will now be eligible for overtime for working those extra hours. And as we know, many American workers work overtime. And it's going to include automatic increases. That's huge.
No, that,
so that every year, there'll be annual increases to that threshold, which means more and more workers will kind of, you know, it'll lift the boats of all these workers.
No, and that's a great thing. Now, I remember, you know, back during the Obama years when this first came up, and, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and their HIT folks were losing their minds. Oh, we can't afford this. This is going to bankrupt companies. They can't afford it. It's going to raise the cost of products. And I remember saying at the time going, you don't have to pay it. You don't have to pay the $55,000.
Right.
You don't have to pay that salary. You just can't abuse people and work them more than 40 hours and not pay them. That's the simple
right.
solution. If you want to pay them 26 grand a year and then after 40 hours pay them overtime, if you can get people to do the job, that's you can do that. This is simply
right.
saying if you're going to use this, you're going to give someone a special title and make them work 100 hours a week, it better be at a reasonable wage.
Right. Right. Exactly. I mean, there still are questions about the duties test, they call it, which means where they have exemptions for managers. And that's still problematic. But I think the Department of Labor wanted to just focus on the threshold and the automatic increases to get something out the door.
Right.
And I think they learned a lesson from what happened in the Obama years where it was legally challenged successfully. So from what the people I've talked to, including former Obama folks, say that they made this legally defensible. Like they really spent about 2 years preparing this rule and how they would overhaul it to be ready for challenges that would come from the business lobby, which will definitely happen in the next few weeks, next few months. You'll see lawsuits come up.
Oh, I'm sure the other NRA will be front and center there. I'm sure a lot of the NFIB
right.
and all of the usual criminals will be out there doing their foolhardy best to screw workers over, because that's what they do, and they do it well. I mean, to be honest, they've got lobbying arms that are second to none, and they've figured out how to get, you know, low-wage workers, especially the other NRA, to actually pay for their lobbying efforts by getting them to take safety courses that they have to pay for.
Right. And this has been a long time coming. I mean, when Marty Walsh first took over as Labor Secretary, when Biden first took over in early 2021, he said that it was too low. The threshold was too low and that he intended to like overhaul the overtime rule. And then it didn't happen. They were like busy planning it and legally and politically and policy wise to get it in shape. And then when Walsh left and Julie Sue was nominated, there's been such a huge confirmation battle over her that they delayed it again. And then I think finally they got to a point where they're kind of like, you know what, even if she's just acting secretary, let's just do it now. And we don't want to wait too much longer, because at the end of the administration, at the end of a term, it's always difficult to get something
yeah.
pushed through. That's what happened to Obama, where he did it too late. And it got, you know, pushed back and the judge knocked it down. And then by that time, the administration didn't have enough time to appeal the ruling. And of course, the Trump people didn't appeal the ruling at all.
Right.
So
no, this is
stuck.
One of those, for me, this last couple of weeks, especially. Where you look at what's coming out of the NLRB, you look at what's coming out of the DOL, you look at all of these
yeah.
things that I've been advocating for the 18 years I've been doing this show. It's they're actually doing this stuff. But I keep saying, look, the reality is, and it's all good stuff. I'm thrilled with all of it. It's good. We need it. We desperately need it. But one election, it could all go away.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's why I think they're pushing it too. Also, OSHA has come through with some interesting rules and regulations just in the last few weeks. So I think they're doing as much as they can, realizing that they need to get it out there because, you know, once it's done, it can be undone, but it can be difficult. So they're trying to like establish and pass and push through as many of these worker-friendly rules as they can while the clock is ticking.
You know, I go back to this, to your article, and you talk about the difference between the 70s and today. And you, in fact, you say at one point, you know, the, 60% of full-time salaried workers in 75 were getting overtime. You know, we forget that, you know, conditions were much more favorable to workers in the past. And I would argue it's because we had strong unions. Even having strong unions for working people helped management. Because, you know, remember, you know, back, you know, years ago when we would negotiate a new contract, management was saying, hey, get as much as you can, because they knew that whatever we got, they would get a bit of it as well. So we made not just our lives better, but theirs too.
Yeah, that's true. No, for sure. For sure. I think one of the sad things about what's happened with overtime is that because it's been so eroded, most people don't even expect it. So people who in the past, in the 70s and 80s, might have said, oh, yeah, you know what? I should get overtime. What's up with this? And they'd ask their managers. They'd find out more about why they're not getting it. And they'd be upset that because it's become so rare, people are not expecting it. People don't even realize it's there. And so if you don't ask for something, you won't get it for sure. It's had this, you know, this damaging effect.
Yeah, this clearly doesn't affect the gig world. And I know I've got a bunch of gig worker listeners who are, no, we don't want any of these protections. We don't want, you know, minimum wage laws or maximum hour laws. We don't want any of this stuff. We're somehow smarter, better. When the reality is, you know, I look at a lot of these gig worker jobs, it's all about cheating on these fronts, ensuring that you never do get, overtime. You never get even minimum wage in some cases. There's a lot to this, and I think a lot we have to be discussing going forward about what employment in this country looks like.
Right. I mean, the new economy does have a lot of gig workers, and that's going to be a problem for how they get compensated fairly. And there's been many examples, as you've talked about on air, with DoorDash and Uber and other places that where they cheat their workers and not pay them adequately, and there's all kinds of ways with tipping that the workers aren't being compensated. And that'll just continue. The more the economy changes to that kind of working workforce that depends on gig work, depends on temporary jobs. Obviously, down the road is AI, and who knows how that's going to, you know, completely alter the landscape, and also give management an upper hand in terms of, you know, being able to threaten workers and get more for less.
Yeah. No.
So this is a first step, but this will, you know, hopefully this is able to survive the challenges and become sort of a new floor, as it were, for workers and for businesses that have to, you know, comply with the rule.
No, to me, this again is another one of those things that Biden has done that I think is good, something that working people need to know about, understand, internalize, and then want to hold on to. This is the election part of all of this. I hope folks will take a look at your article. The Biden administration seeks to expand overtime pay to millions of U.S. workers, written by Marcus Barham. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that over at Capital in Maine. But Marcus, as always, great stuff. I look forward to having you back again and talking about what's coming down the pike.
Definitely. Great. Thank you for having me, Rick. And let's talk again soon.
Anytime. Good stuff. Our good friend Marcus Barham. Make sure you check out the work that they do over at Capital in Maine. Gonna take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I got to tell you, as I've been saying, I think the administration's done some really good work on the employment front. And, you know, I was just thinking during the break, you know, what could they do next? And wage theft seems to be something that I'd like to see some movement on. So, you know, President Biden, if you're up and listening, wage theft. Do something on that. Because what we know is wage theft is a huge, huge problem. Massive. In fact, you know, I love this statistic. I forget the group that put it out. But they said, you know, add up all of the, you know, the bank robberies, the gas station stick-ups, all of the, you know, all the larceny, all of the people stealing from each other's stuff. Add all that up and then multiply it by like 10. And that's what wage theft is in this country. And you go through all of this. Now, understand, you know, what Biden is doing regulatorily with all of these changes is making it easier for people to make a decent living and to get the wages and that they're supposed to. But cutting off all of these ways that employers have been screwing people over. And for me, the other part of this is, you know, this overtime thing has always been just sad. Because I've known people who work in the restaurant industry, for instance, especially fast food, who, you know, they give them like an assistant title, assistant manager title, and then they pay them like the 20. It was at the time it was like 23.6. You're management. You're one of us. You're on the team, and then end up working them 70, 80 hours a week because, you know, someone didn't show up. You got to cover their shift. You've got to stay because nobody, you know. All of this stuff, you're the backstop for their profits. And it was always amazing to me that people would take that. But I remember someone telling me, and it was weird. And I said, you know, why do you do this? You know, why would you put yourself into it? It's well, because I'm on the management track. You know, eventually I'm gonna be the assistant to the assistant, and then just the assistant. Then I'll be the guy. And you go, but in the meantime, you're getting screwed at every turn. And I said, you know, the reality is you should be compensated for your time. And wage theft is one of those things that you know, the number of people that it's happened to is really incredible. Especially the low wage workforce. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, I remember the one time, there's been one time in my life I got cheated out of a week's pay. And I was working for a contractor right out of high school. I was swinging a hammer, building really expensive houses. And I got a nail shot through my foot. Just had my foot, you know, on the, I was, you know, leaning over, I was hammering something, and somebody missed the stud and put the nail right into the bottom of my shoe. And it was there I learned about, contract employees. I was not an actual employee, so I had no workers' comp coverage or no health insurance or no way to, to get compensated for the medical bills that came out of the nail in my foot. I had to cover that myself. Rude awakening. But I also didn't get paid for the 3 days that I worked that week. And there was no way to go and fight it. You know, I was just an 18-year-old kid. You know, I didn't know you could go to the state and file a complaint. Now, would they follow up on it? Who knew at the time? But I remember saying this to people, you know, because as somebody who's been fortunate enough to have a union job my whole life, anytime the employer said, yeah, well, we didn't pay you for this, there was a way to get it back. There was a recourse to claw that back through the union, through the grievance procedure. It took me years to realize that not every worker has that ability. And that sometimes they get cheated repeatedly and knowingly get cheated. And everyone knows they're being cheated. But they accept it because at the end of the road, okay, I'm going to get cheated out of a couple of bucks now, but at least I'm not going to lose my job. Because the power we've given these employers. Now, I go back to the Pennsylvania workers' comp law. They still look at it as a master-servant relationship. So when I look at these employment issues, I look at it from the working person's perspective. And like I said, I'm hoping the administration is looking at something around wage theft as well. There's so much out there that could make lives better. Now, again, you know, I come back to the politics of this. And you know, I've had people say, well, you know, why do you have to bring the politics in? You know, I like your union stuff. I like your work stuff. I like your economy stuff. You know, why do you got to talk politics? Because understand, government decides who gets what. These laws were allowed to prop up. These practices were allowed to continue. This stuff was allowed to go on and on and on because nobody said stop. Because the only person that can hold corporate America accountable is a government of, for, and by you and me, we the people. But we've been almost trained to not think that way. And this is where, you know, the Republicans have done a masterful job. They really have. They've done a masterful job in, you know, the government's evil. And they're until recently, to be honest, you know, their faith in corporate America is waning a bit. And I was thinking about this the other night. There's an opportunity for some unity on this front because, you know, I've been watching some right-wing commentators going on and on about the abuses of corporate America. Now, understand, you know, it's all because, you know, the woke stuff, you know, corporate America and their diversity. We can't have that. We can't have corporations who care about, you know, equality and diversity. No, no. We just want them greedy. We just want them, you know, pursuing their own radical self-interest. Without actually understanding what that is, because diversity and equity could be their radical self-interest. But I digress. There could be a moment where people are fed up with these monopolistic corporations who have robbed us blind on a number of fronts. And this is an opportunity to go, hey, there's an entity that can do that, can hold people accountable. You know, us, through our government. And I say this all the time. It goes back to my eighth grade, you know, civics teacher. Government decides who gets what, which is why we have been getting the short end of the stick for too long. So that's where my mind on this is. And I'm hoping the administration moves in a direction and quickly to go on that because I don't know where else they go from here. To be honest, I was thinking about my bingo card. If I had a wish list bingo card of, you know, what policies would I like to see them move on? I think I've hit bingo already. So wage theft has got to be up there. They did stuff on heat exposure. Maybe hire more OSHA inspectors so it doesn't take 200 years to inspect every site. Maybe that's something we can do. Yeah, I'm excited about the possibilities. The fact that they're reshoring manufacturing and we're seeing apprenticeships growing, that we're seeing job programs growing, we're seeing opportunities grow. This is why when I get people who email me say, well, you beat up on Joe Biden. I don't think so. I think I have been more effusive with praise for him than any politician ever in my lifetime. Because this is the stuff that I've been talking about for years on how we rebuild that prosperous working class. It's that simple. I would like to see better capital borders, maybe. I mean, if we're talking way down wish list, I would like to see our trade policies, you know, revamped to where, again, we put more into domestic production for domestic consumption. I think that is a smart way to go. But to this point, I'm thrilled with the guy. Now, here's the thing. Got to get him reelected. Because all of these policies, while I think they're fabulous, they can be undone. And this is where the politics of understanding who sits in that Oval Office and who they appoint. Because remember, the former guy talked about the very best people. He's going to put the very best people in. And what did those very best people do? They used every regulatory lever to hurt working people, to the advantage of corporate interest, to the moneyed interest. And look, their belief structure is, if it's good for corporate America, it'll eventually trickle down. It'll be good for you at some point down the road. And I think we viscerally know that's not reality. That's not how that game plays. So, like I said, I'm thrilled. I'm looking forward to the next week to see what comes, what the next policy is. But so far, great stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Ney is going to be here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1893. That was the day that the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers and Iron Shipmakers of America was founded in Chicago. This joined two earlier boilermaker unions into one. They decided to establish their headquarters in Kansas City, Kansas. 2 years later, the Boilermakers affiliated with the American Federation of Labor. The union represents members of 250 lodges in the United States and Canada. At the turn of the 20th century, the Boilermakers had about 8,500 members. But their membership expanded, especially during World War II, as shipbuilding grew for the war. By 1944, there were more than 350,000 Boilermakers. In 1954, they merged with the International Brotherhood of Blacksmiths, Drop Forgers, and Helpers, and expanded their name to include these groups of workers. But what exactly is a boilermaker? According to the union's website, the term can have many meanings. It might refer to a Purdue University student or alumni, whose football team started going by the name of the Boilermakers in 1891. Or, Boilermaker might refer to dropping a shot of whiskey into a draft beer and drinking it all at once. But for the labor movement, a Boilermaker is someone that constructs and repairs boilers and the other workers who are part of the union. These might include blacksmiths, forgers, shipbuilders, cement workers, stove workers, metal polishers, and numerous other job descriptions. The Boilermaker's logo reflects these workers. It includes images of a ship, a worker working on a boiler, and a blacksmith's anvil. Below the images are found the words unity, progress, and protection, declaring the mission of the union and its members. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The people are revolting, in the very best meaning of that word. An inspiring example of people rising up against a trifecta of economic, cultural, and political oppression has just come to us from a community of seemingly powerless people living in a very isolated place. Long exploited, lied to, disrespected, and robbed, they revolted, daring to take on the biggest, richest, most politically connected industrial power on the globe, Big Oil. Astonishingly, after a decade of protesting, organizing, coalition building, suing, petitioning, and otherwise resolutely rebelling against injustice, these tenacious people just won an inspiring grassroots victory over Big Oil profiteering. One reason you probably haven't heard about it is that it didn't happen in any of the usual centers of media focus, but in the Amazonian rainforest of Ecuador. Also, this revolt was not led by some brand-name environmental group or charismatic political honcho, but by the Tagere and Taro-Manani tribes and other indigenous Warani people living in the rich biodiversity of Ecuador's Yosemite National Park. Directly challenging the exigent crisis of climate change, the Warani rallied the region's young people into a potent political force. They successfully organized behind a national referendum to 1. Ban oil drilling in the region, 2. Compel the profiteers to remove their wells and pipelines, and 3. Pay for remediation and reforestation. Significantly, they specifically called for leaving oil in the ground so it would not add to climate destruction. And the proposed ban was binding, unable to be overturned by future lobbyists and officials. This is Jim Hightower saying a resounding 58% of Ecuadorians said yes. As a Warani leader noted, this is the day the planet started to win.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, Marjorie Three Names is putting down her demands. The only way she's going to vote to not shut the government down is if she gets her impeachment inquiry. Not an impeachment. No, no. Just the inquiry. You know, we need the inquiry because they've got nothing, but they need it because it's the red meat that's going to keep everybody all bunched up in the panties. But this is the only way, according to her, that she sees us funding our government. When can we get rid of crackpots like this? Please, Georgia, please, I'm begging you. There's got to be someone sane and rational within your county borders or within your district to get rid of this. It's just got to be. It's just got to be. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on this and the other top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So what do you think of this? The pound of flesh is, I'll vote to not destroy our economy. I'll vote to not shut the government down and cause pain and misery for thousands of federal workers. But my pound of flesh is I got to have my impeachment inquiry.
You know, the thing that shocked or disappointed me is the White House responding. You know what they need to say? I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Yeah.
Seriously. Just say, I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, okay? But, they're saying that the last thing American people deserve is for extreme House members to trigger government shutdown. It just gives her, this is what she wants. She wants recognized. Let them deal with her. Look, there's members of the Republican caucus that do not want an impeachment inquiry. Let them fight her. Let her fight them. It's a circular firing squad. Let them go at it.
Yeah. No, I'm all in favor of it. No, please, by all means. Go ahead. Do your impeachment thing. Go ahead. Because, you've got nothing. Every time James Comer says, hey, we've got a witness, we've got a secret whistleblower, they can't find him. They build up, we've got all this information, and then, well, not really. We've got some allegations that we think might possibly be true, that somebody made up or thought dreamt up. I mean, by all means, go ahead. If that's the best you can do to make the lives of us better, knock yourself out. Go do your impeachment inquiry.
Marjorie Taylor Greene does this, to appeal to certain people in her district. Like I said, if I was the White House, I would ignore her. I really, on this case, if the speaker says it, that's different. But don't give her attention like she's, running the place.
I'm with you. I got to get your thoughts on some of the sentencing today. You got to be a little bit happier with some of the sentences coming out. You got the Joe Biggs guy yesterday, 17 years. You got this other guy, Ethan Nordine, 18 years. Another guy got 10 years. This Spazzolini, I guess, is his nickname. Now we're getting down to somebody doing some real time.
Right, because you and I talked about this. The first sentence out of the box was like, okay, you can't you do better than that? you know, it needed to get tougher, because a tough sentence means more plea deals, yeah, is what that means, which saves trial time. And then you do the plea deal, and people, you know, people do some time over this. Some said, well, it's not enough, and some said it's too much. So, yeah, judge went in the middle, but it's a long enough sentence, and it's federal time. You have to do 85% of federal time. There's no parole board, as in the most state governments. So 85% of the time, they're going to do it.
Well, you know, and good for them. You know, at the end of the day, now they'll get to see just how wonderful the prison system is, because I guarantee, and this is what I've been saying all through this, especially the people who are complaining about the D.C. jail, which I do understand is a horrible place. But the whining that's going on, I guarantee these are the folks who are saying, you know, jail's just too easy on people. They shouldn't have, you know, swimming pools and color TVs. Because I don't know about you, but I know lots of people who believe jail is like Club Med.
Well, believe me, you're talking to somebody that here, but I still hear it. Oh, you went to Club Fed, you know, because they did that documentary years ago. And, you know, do they have a ping pong table there? Yeah. Do they have, you know, one treadmill or two? Yes, they do. You know, there's an email system that you can't get on the internet, but you can send, they read it, send it. You're limited to 10 people for communication purposes. When they say libraries, they're, you know, they've got some books, and it's small, but it's no Club Fed, and you know, it's now it is warehousing. You know, you got a test, you want to, you need a proctor and accounts for your school program. And I knew one guy that was going through a high university, and the guards wouldn't proctor for him, and so he lost his entire quarter. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not Club Fed.
No, that's
Club Punishment.
No, and this is where maybe they're going to come out, and maybe they're going to – it's going to be interesting to see how some of these people come out, and especially the ones who got real sentences, the ones who got 6 months. You know, this is – you know, it's a badge of honor for them. But the people who come out with real sentences, it'll be interesting to see what they come out and what they do after this.
Well, here's what will happen to them too, because, look, I was incarcerated with 1,300 people. And what ends up happening, now we didn't have any, you know, Proud Boys, but we had people, you know, pretty significant, you know, in some crimes they committed and things. And we had some, you know, wealthy people, et cetera. You had all types of people. But what will happen with the Proud Boys is they'll go in there and they'll be like, you know, wow, it's the Proud Boys. Wow, we stormed the Capitol. And that'll get them some notoriety and make them feel like, wow, you know, they're really kind of on top of the system for about 3 to 4 months. And that will end. And then they will be, like, not only bored out of their minds, but ready to pull their hair out. So, yeah, that notoriety will last a little while. And, by the way, if they get any notions of talking to the press, good luck on that, too.
No, jail's one of those places I've never wanted to be, and I'm glad I haven't. But, you know, sometimes it's interesting to see where they're going to play out. Speaking of jail, I'm watching Rudy Giuliani. I was thinking about this today. You know, the Trump fall from, you know, from the high perch has been, you know, pretty bad. But Giuliani, I mean, this has got to be the biggest fall from grace, and probably, like, I would argue, probably in the history of this country. He was America's mayor. I mean, he was at the, you know, after 9/11, he was the guy. He was the guy who slayed the mob. He was the guy who was the mayor of New York during 9/11. And to see what he has become, wow. And this story today, and I got to get your thoughts on this, because I know you're not a big fan of Giuliani, especially with his dealings with the Mujahideen cult. But they're now saying, a whistleblower from the FBI is now saying that he was compromised by Russian intelligence. Because he was traipsing around Ukraine looking for any dirt possible on Joe Biden. And they're saying, you know, well, you know, and the guy actually, his name is out there. There's no secret whistleblower. This is a whistleblower that someone actually found. Any thoughts on this?
Right. This story, I think, is really appalling. You know, the FBI agent says that Giuliani was co-opted by Russian intelligence. Whether co-opted without him knowing it or co-opted with him knowing it, either way, they're saying he was co-opted. And then, of course, the FBI itself is declining to, you know, say anything at this point in time. But at one time, I mean, I really, really liked Giuliani. I really did. I mean, I think he really took some good steps in New York. He was the nation's mayor. He handled 911. You know, he was just something else. And after he left, you know, I was one of those like, hey, Giuliani could be, you know, run for president. I was in that category. And then the first strike, as you mentioned, the Mujahideen call, which was on the terror list, which was also supported by John Bolton, but Rudy did it for money. And at that point in time, I started to say, wow, he signed up with a terrorist group. It was at that time. It's not designated anymore, to make it clear, but it was. And they took our hostages. They were responsible. And he signed up with them. I think he took $125,000, $150,000, I forget. And when he did that, of a group that's an official terrorist group, I thought, money is going to be the ruination of this guy. Yeah. And then it just got worse from there. You know, he did things for money. And then I think he wanted to be important, you know, so he would advise Trump, including being intoxicated, advising Trump, which he might have advised him maybe with better advice when he was intoxicated, you think? I don't know.
No, look, I mean, you know, the sad reality is alcohol ruins a lot of lives.
Yes.
I look at Rudy going, you know, maybe lay off the sauce.
But he's not stopping. I'm in recovery myself. You know, I make no bones about it. But he didn't stop. He's still at it. And then all the other things in the movie where he was laying on the bed, and I'm like, wow. I mean, he could have been a think tank guy. He could have went around the country and gave speeches, you know, on whatever issues he wanted, including, you know, beating up the government here and there. But instead, he's getting disbarred. He's in criminal trials, you know, everything under the sun. It's really sad. It is a sad ending. It really is.
No, it is. And I come back to, it was Trump that did it to him. Yeah. I mean, Trump finally put the nail in the coffin. I mean, he was headed down that path. But, you know, he's now going broke. He doesn't have money to pay his lawyers, evidently. He's selling his apartment. He's, you know, all this horrible stuff is happening to him because of he bought into this stuff. And I got to wonder, you know, because I saw this story that this, you know, an FBI agent, you know, says he's been turned by the Russians. And immediately my mind goes, you know, because the Trump world has done a great job of inoculating us against anything that Russia does. So, you know, immediately when I saw this, my mind goes, well, you know, they're going to say it's a hoax. You know, it's a witch hunt. You know, it's all that stuff. But this guy, this Jonathan Bouma, actually put his name on it, which was shocking to me.
Well, and also, Giuliani had a relationship with Pavel Fuchs, who was, you know, he's a wealthy Ukrainian developer. And then he hired Giuliani. Now, there were two different versions of why he hired him, Giuliani's version and then his version. And then he changed his version, Fuchs did, back to Giuliani's version. But here's the bottom line. They're making the statement that the FBI assessed Fuchs, who paid Giuliani, that Fuchs was a co-opted asset of Russian intelligence services. So they used him to advance their goals. And, you know, Giuliani was wrapped up in that. And, you know, I mean, I know very well, you get wrapped up with people, and if they smell, you smell. And that's what happens. And the odor coming from Giuliani now is unbelievable. I mean, again, what a way to end what used to be a well-respected career.
No, I mean, it's amazing to me. I mean, I was,
and you know, Rick, it's not one of the Americans love second chances. They do. It's a great country for, you know, having grace and stuff. But with Rudy Giuliani, he's never going to repair this damage.
No, he can't recover from this.
He can't. It's done.
No, and there's a point at which you go, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to. He needs to be locked up. I mean, that's where my mind goes. You know, with all of the stuff that's going on, all of the. Well, for instance, you know, he didn't even put up a defense in the defamation suit that was brought against him. And I guess, you know, legal experts have said he didn't want to go through discovery because there's probably a lot of bad stuff in there that will most certainly be used against him.
And he's out on his own, and Trump didn't pay him, and he's not part of the system anymore. And I'm not sure because he's so far down and so far in trouble, I'm not sure that people will come to his defense.
Yeah.
You know, when you get in trouble, if you're, you know, if you've got some past relationships, you've got some friendships, et cetera, and if you're not too hot of a hot potato, people will step in to give you some help. But when you've reached Giuliani status, I don't think a lot of the wealthy cats are going to be opening the checkbook up to helping.
No, I don't think so either. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. I got to get your thoughts on Mitch McConnell. You know, I don't wish anybody ill. I hope he's okay. I hope he, you know, retires and goes off, you know, does his thing. I've got some people emailing me, you know, saying, you know, hope bad things for him. I don't wish anybody bad because I believe in karma. But I do find it interesting that Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear has said that, or has declined to say that he would appoint a Republican if that seat becomes vacant. I got to tell you, my thought on this is there is no way in a cold day that I would replace that seat with a Republican if I were the Democrat, only because Mitch McConnell, in the spirit of Mitch McConnell, would have never appointed a Democrat to replace a Democrat. He'd have stolen the seat. What do you think?
I mean, they can appoint whoever they want, correct?
Yes.
Doesn't have to be Republican.
No.
Okay. So, and so what you're saying is, what would a Democrat governor do?
The Democratic governor declined to say whether he was going to follow the state law. Now, evidently, there is a state law in Kentucky that they have to replace somebody with the same party.
Oh, they do.
But he said he's declined to say whether he's going to follow that law. Well, I'm of the mindset that Mitch McConnell would not have followed that law.
Well, I think if there is a law, that's why I was wondering, if there's a law, he's a Democrat governor, and there's a law, he probably will follow to appoint a Republican.
And that's why Democrats lose.
You know? If there's a law.
Yeah, no, I mean, now, this is one of those things that this is why the Republicans win, because I don't think they would. Finally, got to get your thought on Matt Schlapp.
Do I think Mitch would?
Yes.
I'm sorry, no, he wouldn't. No.
See?
Remember what he did with judges?
Yes. Well,
let's wait till the election. Oh, wait a minute, now we got our guy, we won't wait till the next election? Of course he. Oh, no.
Heads I win, tails you lose. Finally, got to get your thoughts on the CPAC guy, this Matt Schlapp. Evidently, Matt and his wife, Mercedes, it's time for a new beginning, I guess. And they held an exorcism. They held an exorcism in the CPAC offices.
Are you making this up?
I am not making this up.
I haven't heard that. Matt Schlapp held an exorcism?
As part of a reset, the Schlapps turned to a priest to evict satanic spirits from their D.C. offices. Because, look, you know, Schlapp's got all these young guys that he's been fondling and groping and pursuing.
Oh, the story is on Walker's campaign. The story is hideous. It's not just, it's hideous. I've read it twice.
Yeah, I mean, so there's all this stuff. So, of course, I guess if you're in that world, it's the demons made me do it. The devil made me do it. So this seems almost logical if you try and put yourself in that kind of that mindset that, you know, the devil made me do it. So we've got to exorcise the demons. Well, so why not do an exorcism?
Well, let me say this. As far as a 12-year Catholic school, you know, grad, do I believe in the Church's dogma on the ability to teach exorcisms to priests? Yes, I do. Is it possible a case that someone could have a type of demon possession? Possibly they could. Should CPAC have a exorcism? Absolutely not. Exorcism for what? Because the employees resigned. They were protesting what happened last year with Matt Schlapp and the whole scandal. That's why they resigned. They didn't resign because they were demon-possessed. This is unreal. Why would you do that?
Because you know, this is one of those weird things. You know, I had a guy, Jeff Charlotte, on the show a number of years back. He wrote a book about C Street, about the religious folks who they believe that they're entitled, that they're chosen. So no matter what they do wrong, it's forgiven because they're the chosen. You know, the Sanford, Mark Sanford, the guy from, South Carolina, who was down on the Appalachian Trail. He was one of those people. That's how he got to be a congressman again. This fits that mold in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, if one of the employees' heads was turning backwards and things, and they were spitting across the room, I would say bring the priest in. But if they're resigning because they're like really kind of angry at Max Schlapp, I'm not sure that the priest is the right. Maybe I don't know. Bring maybe the lawyers in. I don't know.
But we're gonna exorcise the demons and no more harassing young men.
You can't make this stuff up.
No,
you can't.
No, and if you did, no one would believe you.
No one. No, they would turn us away and put us away.
There you go. Bob, I hope you have a good holiday. Happy Labor Day.
You too. Happy Labor Day.
Look forward to talking to
all the workers out there.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Bob Nay. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Yeah, maybe during the break we'll do a little exorcism here in the studio. Oh man. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1859. That was the day the first Pullman sleeping car made an overnight trip. The first Pullman sleeper was a renovated day coach. That first trip was made on the Chicago and Alton Railroad, between Bloomington, Illinois, and Chicago. Pullman continued to improve his sleeping cars to make long-distance train travel more comfortable and luxurious. Inspired by company towns in Essen, Germany and Saltire, England, Pullman bought land south of Chicago to build his company town. He named his new town Pullman and moved all of his manufacturing operations there. There were other sleeping cars at that time, but George Pullman refined the sleeping car and built a monopoly. As for his company town, initially it seemed to be a great success. Visitors to Chicago flocked to Pullman to view the model town. But then there was a severe economic depression in 1893. This caused Pullman to lower the wages of his employees. However, Pullman did not also lower the rents he charged to live in the company town. Prices of goods for sale in the town were not lowered either. Disgruntled workers went on strike. Many of the strikers joined the American Railway Union, started by Eugene V. Debs. This union organized a boycott, and railroad workers across the country refused to service any train with a Pullman car. The U.S. Attorney General issued an injunction demanding that the strikers cease in their activities or face being fired. Eventually, President Cleveland sent in federal troops to end the boycott. As a result, 30 workers were killed across the nation. Pullman died a few years later, and today, his Pullman Palace car that transformed the transportation industry is a relic of history. But his legacy of slashing wages lives on. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Real quick, I'm going to wrap up with a couple of emails. Lewis sent me an email agreeing with me on the higher education front, and I like when I get these emails. He said, Rick, you've never spoken more true words about the education situation in our country right now. He says, I was an academic for over 26 years at the university level, and it is all about money. He says, I've taught in elite private universities and at state schools. What both have in common? Making that money. At the state school I used to teach at, the university instituted a policy where, now get this, if a student got a C, they could take the class over. In my day, and probably yours, the only way you could take a class over is if you got an F or anything else. That was not a do-over. Now green rules, very sad indeed. And look, I've had this conversation with numerous professors who tell me the same thing. You know, and they get pressure from above if they give bad grades because they want people going through. And TB in Santa Fe sends me some thoughts on. Look, I understand Biden has had problems. I understand he's got a speech impediment. I understand he's had stuff. I'm just pointing out the reality of Biden's getting up there in age. He doesn't speak as well as Obama did or as Clinton did. But for me, that's not important. What's important is what he is doing. That's what's important. But she points out the important part in all of this. And the part that maybe I haven't made clear enough. Yeah, the Republicans are beating him up because he's not a good speaker. And I'm not beating him up. I'm just simply agreeing. Yeah, he's not a great speaker. It is what it is. And I think he would probably tell you, he's not a great speaker. He's got some issues. He's a good policy guy. I'm spot on the policy. Spot on making people's lives better. And when the debates come and when the election comes, as answering that question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago when everything was locked down under the former guy? You're going to have to answer yes. But she does ask the question, what are Republicans doing? And the answer is nada. She's absolutely right. They're whining about Joe being not a good speaker. And she is right. So I'm with you, TB. I'm 100% there. Simply saying, admit the deficiencies and then move forward on the strengths.